Hi, good afternoon or good morning, wherever you are. I am Shoshana Bryan, the Senior Director of the Jewish Policy Center. I want to welcome you all today, and I will be your moderator. Before we begin, your phone lines are muted, not because we don't like you, but because we're trying to be efficient. We'd love to have your questions, though. Please send them by email to info@jewishpolicycenter.org or tweet them to @thejpc, and we're monitoring both lines. Our guest today, Dr. Stephen Bryan, is an expert in security, strategy, and technology. He's held senior positions in the Defense Department on Capitol Hill and as the president of a large multinational defense and technology company. He did his undergraduate work at Rutgers University and received his MA and PhD from Tulane University, where he was a National Defense Scholar. He did postdoctoral work at Virginia Polytechnic Institute and State University, now better known and more happily known as Virginia Tech. Steve writes for Asia Times, American Thinker, The National Interest, and many other newspapers and magazines. JPC members have read his work in Focus Quarterly, and he has another article coming out in our fall issue. He's published 4 books on security subjects, most recently one on security for religious institutions. Steve is a senior fellow at the American Center for Democracy. He serves as a senior fellow for Il Nodo di Gordio, the Gordian Knot, an Italian think tank, and as a fellow of the Taiwan Institute for Political, Economic, and Social Studies. He's going to talk to us today about Russia, explosions, hypersonic weapons, and our ability or inability to meet new threats. Again, please send your questions by email to info@jewishpolicycenter.org or tweet them to @thejpc. Steve, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Shoshana. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to your organization and group today. I guess everyone knows that on August 8th, 2019 this year, about 9 o'clock in the morning, Russia time, two explosions, according to the Norwegian censors, happened in a place called Nianoska, which is in Arkhangelsk on the White Sea, very close to the Arctic Circle. The explosion is rather mysterious. The Russians have admitted that the explosion released radioactive materials, although they haven't been completely straightforward on what they all were. They've announced some of them, but not others. A number of people were killed. There were 5 employees of Rosatom, which is Russia's nuclear agency. They were killed, including a very senior member, and 2 service members were killed. The explosion took place on a barge in the White Sea, in the bay there in the White Sea, just off the coast. We don't know very much exactly the sequence of events, and we actually don't even know formally what the weapon was that was being tested. But most of the experts think it was a hypersonic test of a hypersonic vehicle, a vehicle that the Russians have been testing and not successfully so far, called the Burevestnik. This is a hypersonic vehicle that's launched from a rocket. It then goes into near space and into the exoatmosphere and can loiter there for an unlimited amount of times if it works correctly. It uses what's called a scramjet engine, but the propulsion is provided by a nuclear reactor that essentially takes the incoming compressed air from the vehicle and burns it at very, very high temperature, causing a significant amount of thrust and allowing the vehicle essentially to use the atmosphere as its fuel. What exactly happened in this test, we don't know. There were 2 previous tests, one at a place in Novaya Zemlya, which is not so far away. That one was back in November 2017. It failed. And another one this same year, in past January, in Kapustin Yar, which is in the southern, near what is now called Volgograd, which used to be Stalingrad. So that's a rough outline of the situation. I would just like to mention a little bit about the technology, because I think it's important to know what it is. The notion of using a nuclear reactor for powering a vehicle is not new. In fact, the United States started as far back as 1946, started by wanting to put a nuclear reactor in a bomber, so it could fly endlessly as a kind of a nuclear bomber. That was actually tested, and it flew for a while on a B-36. It wasn't successful, and the project was abandoned. And then later, we had a much more ambitious project, which was to essentially build a supersonic ramjet-powered vehicle using a nuclear reactor. And that project was started in 1961 and terminated in 1964. They actually tested it on the ground at Jackson Flats, Nevada, on two occasions. Demonstrated that it would work, but it's a very risky proposition to run that kind of vehicle. I think that's what the Russians are discovering at the moment. First of all, because it spews out radioactivity, even if it operates correctly. And that's number one. Number two, the actual reactor that's on board, and the one that the United States built, was about 6 feet long and about 3 feet wide. The particular reactor was not shielded. That means that all the radiation generated by the reactor would impact anyone near it. And of course, if it was actually flown, it would be spewing radiation throughout the atmosphere on its flight path. And I imagine this is exactly what we saw in the Oska with the Russians. The original American reactor carried around 40 pounds of highly enriched uranium, which is quite a lot because it's getting close to the amount of uranium that was used in the first atomic bomb. And I would guess that the Russians did the same thing. I don't think there's anything different. The only thing that's really different about this entire matter is that instead of being strapped to a ramjet, it's strapped to a scramjet, which is a hypersonic weapon. As you may know, the difference between a ramjet and a hypersonic weapon or scramjet has to do with how fast it goes. So a supersonic weapon can fly from Mach 1, that's one times the speed of sound, up to about five times the speed of sound. And anything that's hypersonic flies from five times forward up to as far as 20 times the speed of sound. Now, any vehicle like this that flies at these terrific speeds has to be made out of very special materials. And you can imagine that what happens when this flies around in the atmosphere is it gets very, very hot, sort of like the spacecraft you've seen, the space shuttle and other things coming. As they come into the atmosphere, they have to have special tiles and they generate vast amounts of heat. But this would be generating vast amounts of heat all the time, plus the reheat of the reactor, which is over 2,000 degrees centigrade. So it's a tremendous engineering task to build something like this. It's extremely dangerous, both while it's sitting on the launch pad and while it's flying around and while it's delivering its weapons. It's dangerous in all aspects. And the U.S. abandoned it just for that reason, because it was too dangerous. So that's kind of the initial background. I think what I'd like to do is just to say that we're entering a hypersonic age. That is to say, we're entering an age where the hypersonic weapons are going to be around more and more. Now, not all of them are nuclear. In fact, most of them are not at all nuclear. They're usually launched with a rocket, but then they have a fuel on board, usually some kind of oxidizing fuel to keep them flying during their course of flight. And the reason they're being developed and the reason that they're something new is because right now all our air defenses and everyone's air defenses in the world, not just American, are unable to deal with a hypersonic weapon. It's far too fast for any interceptor that we currently have. and even too fast for some of our radars. So it's become a kind of threat to the existing balance of security that exists in, for the United States and for everybody else. And that's why everybody's worried about it. And that's why it's a game changer. So I think I'll stop there as a basic introduction to the subject, and I'll be very happy to take questions.
So the first question that we have, Russia's nuclear monitors failed or were turned off after the explosion for a period of a couple of days. Is that like the cameras on Jeffrey Epstein's jail cell? Is that just something that happened?
I don't know about Jeffrey Epstein's jail cell, but I know that the Russian four Russian stations were shut down, and they all shut down at the same time, which is rather interesting. These were put there to deal with the test ban treaty. That's what they're there for, the Atmospheric Test Ban Treaty. And they're not the only ones in the world. There are other, the Norwegians, for example, their monitors were working. But the Russians shut them all down, I think because they didn't want the alarm to spread around the rest of the country. After the Chernobyl disaster, especially, the sensitivity about radiation is very, very great in Russia. And people are very nervous about that kind of thing. And this disaster, not on the scale of Chernobyl, certainly spewed out a lot of radiation. And with the prevailing winds, it would head south and west. So there was, I think on the Russian side, a lot of concern about the public learning about this. And they tried to suppress it. They tried to hide it. They tried to tell people everything was okay, but nowadays people walk around with their own radiation monitors, so they know what's going on, and that's exactly what happened here as early as the same day of the disaster, when people in the nearby city of Sverdlovsk started to detect radioactive iodine in the atmosphere at high levels.
So the Russians were attempting to keep information from their own people, possibly from other people in Europe. Did any of that radiation spread beyond Russian territory?
We don't know 100%. We don't really know too much. The Norwegians have picked up traces of the radiation, but I think their wind direction is the wrong way. So they didn't get too much, but they did get some. But I think it's spreading south. I think the places to look would be more south and southwest. So far, no.
Reminder, if you have questions, info@jewishpolicycenter.org. We have another question. American and Israeli ballistic missile defenses are predicated on countering a different sort of technology. Will hypersonic missiles make our investments in missile defense obsolete? And there will be a follow-up question to that.
Well, it won't make all our missile defense obsolete, but it'll mean that we're going to have to add to our missile defenses. I mean, there's still ICBMs or ballistic missiles of all intermediate range ballistic missiles, which is what the Israeli systems are calculated against primarily. And those will remain in the inventory for the next 50 years. So that part of the existing infrastructure is probably valid. But the missing part is we don't have anything to deal with hypersonics, neither on the tactical level or on the strategic level. And you might have seen last week the Pentagon canceled a program for a new interceptor that was going to go into the ground-based mid-course ballistic missile defense system, which is our most effective and sophisticated missile defense system. It's located in Alaska and in California. Mostly in Alaska. It doesn't have anything to do with Russians. It has to do with Koreans and Chinese. In any case, that program was canceled very abruptly, I think, because the realization that in a few years it would be obsolete without some major changes to account for hypersonic weapons. Chinese are also working on hypersonic weapons, not only the Russians.
So you've just covered two more of our questions. one was, do we have any sense of how well developed U.S. is in countering these weapons? And the other was about China. There's a third question. Is there any reason to believe that North Korea is also working on the development of hypersonic weapons?
No, I don't think no one has reported anything from North Korea that would suggest that they're working on hypersonic weapons. What the North Koreans appear to be working on, according to the Japanese, which I think are correct, is they're working on maneuverable warheads for their missiles. In other words, another aspect of missile defense, and particularly the systems like Patriot and SM-3 and others, is that they essentially assess the trajectory of the missile and then they move to intercept it. But if the missile changes its trajectory in mid-course or anywhere else along the flight path, these systems aren't able to adjust and to do the interception. So what the Japanese have signaled is the Koreans are now, or appear to be now, working on missiles, that a new generation of missiles that can change their trajectory and therefore get around any missile defenses that Japan or the United States might have.
I'm going to put two questions together here. The first part of the question is, what is Putin's strategy likely to be now? Will the Russians work harder to fix the problem and keep the program going, or will it quietly terminate the program? And the second part is, how important is it for the West to continue to pursue answers and not let this incident die? Do we have work going on in universities, in military labs, on this issue that we'll keep doing regardless of what the Russians do next?
Okay, those are two very difficult questions to answer. Obviously, I left my crystal ball upstairs, so I'm not sure.
Well, I left the difficult ones
answer.
Toward the end.
Yeah, I think the first thing to keep in mind is that as far as the Russians are concerned, that this was the third test involving a nuclear reactor in a hypersonic weapon that's taken place. So whether they'll go ahead with a fourth one is anyone's guess, but they took the big hit this time because of the deaths that occurred, and especially one of the senior designers was killed. So that's going to be a real setback for them. Will they stop? I don't think so. I think they'll keep going. I think this is a case where hypersonic weapons are going to be here. I mean, I think we have to accept that. But hypersonic weapons that run with nuclear reactors is a very bad and very dangerous idea, extremely problematic. And one of the places maybe we could get some arms control is over that kind of system. Where, you know, the U.S. would agree not to develop, the Russians would agree not to develop, but it would have to also include the Chinese. And the Chinese have not been willing to do arms control, as you may be aware, none at all. So there's a real diplomatic challenge, their political challenge. But I have a feeling that at this point, given the failures in Russia, at least, that the Russians may be open to that conversation. So I think that's the answer to your first part of your question. The second question is, I don't know. I mean, the U.S. has been not doing a very good job on missile defense, period. Not to mention hypersonic weapons, but I mean, we've been very tardy in doing missile defenses. That's why the Israelis, who have a much more comprehensive approach to the problem, are probably further along in terms of a comprehensive system than we are. I mean, keep in mind that we don't have any missile defenses on our East Coast, for that matter, over, you know, facing Canada, where the most likely Russian attacks, if there were Russian attacks, would come from. The only thing we have is something on the West Coast, which is aimed at mostly at North Korea and a little bit at China. We have a very inadequate system that we are putting in Poland, and we temporarily deployed a SM-3 system to Romania, but that's been pulled out already. So, I mean, we're way behind in this whole area of missile defense, and mostly that's come about because A lot of people have wanted to argue, have argued, not wanted to, but have argued that we should rely on mutually assured destruction as the only approach that will effectively prevent arms, any nuclear exchange. In other words, we would have enough stuff to shoot at the Russians, and if they shot stuff at us, they would surely be killed, so they wouldn't do it. But that's called the MAD doctrine, M-A-D, mutual assured destruction. It's not the approach Israel's taking. It's obviously not the approach we're taking on the West Coast. But as far as Russia's concerned, it is actually the approach because we don't have anything. So I think we have to really rethink our whole approach to missile defenses in this country and get serious. And now with the hypersonic challenge, it's an even bigger conundrum, I think. Can we find a way to deal with hypersonic weapons? Yeah, I think we can, but we're not there yet. We're not even close.
Well, that was really depressing. So I'm going to go back to questions that have more, let's say, objective answers. Here's a question. These missiles, when they explode, do they spread nuclear material in addition to their explosive effect? And does this by itself violate nonproliferation treaties?
Yeah, there's a little bit of a debate about whether this missile that the Russians, the scramjet with the nuclear reactor, which is whether it actually violates any treaty. The answer is it probably doesn't at the present time. Now, the reason there was the release of radioactivity is because the thing exploded on the launch pad. It wasn't because of any other reason. But does it? I think the place to look is the atmospheric test agreement, which you could try to extend to this, but it right now doesn't cover it in any explicit way. And that's because, we've had that in place for a long time. It has stopped atmospheric testing. And when you fire this missile, whether you like it or not, you're spewing out radiation even in the testing, because the way it works is when that air, compressed air, comes in through the inlet, it crosses a nuclear reactor that's unshielded and unprotected. And what comes out the end is effluent, which is full of radioactivity. So it's going into the atmosphere. The Russians are busy cleaning up the mess in the White Sea right now. They can't clean up what's in the atmosphere, but they're cleaning up what got into with some of the stuff that fell into the water, including parts of the reactor. In fact, one diver already died trying to pull the stuff out of the water. So I think the answer is we could probably try to extend the atmospheric test ban agreement, which goes back to the 1960s, and maybe the Russians would be willing to do that at this point.
Okay. Last question, because we promised not to take up everybody's entire lunch hour. Does the miniaturization of these weapons or any nuclear weapon make them more likely to be used in your estimation?
That's an interesting, these are not very miniature. I mean, to begin with, the ones that we're talking about here is a fairly large weapon when it sits on the launch pad, because it includes a standard rocket engine, plus a nuclear reactor, plus the structure for the scramjet. So it's probably 12 feet tall. Is that miniature? I don't think it is. But along those lines, and quickly, it's very hard to see, because it's not like an ICBM where when it goes off, you can really pick it up. It's a much smaller rocket. And in that sense, it does raise questions about being able to verify tests and being able to intercept too. There's a real serious issue there. But I don't think being small really is the issue. I think that what's really important is the fact that it's a nuclear device and that it's dangerous.
Excuse me. We are going to end the call now. So my last question to you is, what would you like to leave us with? What should we understand about what the Russians were doing and what we're going to need to do for the future? Where should we be looking?
Well, there's three things. I mean, first of all, we have to prepare defenses against hypersonic weapons, both at the tactical and strategic level. We have no choice in that. We have to do it. The second is, I think there's an opportunity to talk to the Russians about using nuclear reactors and weapons because of the obvious dangers to the environment, both in testing and, of course, even if they sit on the launch pad, they're damn dangerous things. And it's a very bad idea from that perspective. And thirdly, I think we can expect a lot of proliferation. Now that the Russians have tried this, I would imagine the Chinese will try it. The North Koreans may eventually try it, but certainly the Chinese will. They already have a hypersonic program. And they surely are watching what the Russians are doing. So those would be the three thoughts I have right away.
Thank you. On behalf of the members of the JPC and our friends that called in today, thank you very much. It's a little depressing, but that was really enlightening. So we appreciate your time and we appreciate the information. To the listeners, there will be a conference call next month with Richard Baer, and we will send you information on it. Thank you, and we wish you all a good day.